I would like to request Brother Hafif Khan. Brother Hafif Khan is the editor of the first ever Tafsir-e Quran written in English by Imam Al-Asi. It is called The Ascendant Quran. Brother Hafif is also the editorial board of Crescent International Magazine. Please join me. Welcome Brother Hafif Khan.
Assalamu alaikum. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له له الحمد وله الملك يحيي ويميت بيده الخير وهو على كل شيء قدير وأشهد أن محمدًا عبد الله ورسوله وصفيه وخليله أرسله الله للناس نذيرا وبشيرا. Brothers and sisters, committed Muslims, I'd like to begin first of all, by expressing my gratitude to the organizers for bringing me on board today to express some of my thoughts on this occasion. It's an important occasion, and it ought to be marked with the degree of reverence and sensitivity that has been so far expressed by the other brothers who have joined me on this panel, and I'm sure by those who will follow me. I'd like to begin my comments by citing the fortuitousness of the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing this year, as it coincides with a large number of protests that are going on across the world. As many of you might recognize, crises of this nature tend to reveal the strength and the resilience of a particular civil society. And with regard to the nature of the protests that are going on across the world right now, these protests have begun to expose the cracks in the armor of what is otherwise perceived to be an invincible structure. And these cracks are appearing on the level of race, on the level of economic deprivation, on the level of social hedonism, on the level of degradation of the environment, and on almost every other level. And we are witnessing firsthand that the dominant power culture, and this is taking place in our lifetime right now, is transforming itself from a republic into an empire, into sort of a maximalist dictatorship. And the elected representatives of that empire are busy transforming themselves into kings and Caesars. And then, of course, there are the protests that are going on. These are attempts by principled people, by deprived people, by oppressed people, to redress the wrongs that have been covered up by a consuming ambiance of consumption and materialism and graft and corruption. And in a similar sense, some 41 years ago, there were also protests that were going on halfway across the world. And in these particular protests, what these particular protests did with regard to the Islamic peoples of Iran is that they anchored in a set of transformative changes into a new civil society that was going to be built, an Islamic scriptural society. And the reason that those protests, even though they were 41 years ago, four decades ago, the reason that those protests serve as a model for liberation and freedom-loving activities today is that those protests were led by a great man. In fact, what made those protests distinctive is that this great man was leading them. He was a moral man. He was a political man. He was a man who appears once in a lifetime. He was a man who appears once every 100 years. And often these characteristics, morality and political acumen, don't exist in the same person. For indeed, it was the Imam himself who said that anybody who says that Islam and politics don't mix, he neither understands Islam and he definitely does not understand politics. And so what made these protests distinctive is that Imam Khomeini was leading them. And he led them into a direction where these transformative changes had the chance of creating a new society. And in the world that we live in today, it is so ironic that the ones who continue to criticize the legacy of the Imam are the ones who are presiding over societies that are self-destructing, that are destroying not only themselves, but perhaps a good part of the rest of the world. And yet the Imam himself, despite all of this criticism, he is the one who presided over shaping a new society, helping a new society emerge, a transformative society, a leading society, a model society, a beacon society. And so today, as these protests go on, there are things that the current protesters can learn from those protests that were led by the Imam some 41 years ago. And I hope to concentrate the rest of my talk on what those who are protesting for justice and for liberation today can learn from the Imam and can learn from the people that the Imam led. One of the first things that ought to be obvious to the protesters today, and it may be obvious to many of them, that the rights that you have on paper are not the same as the rights that you have in fact. The rights on paper are obviously your constitutional rights. And governments today, especially the governments in the materialistic West, they pride themselves on congratulating themselves. In fact, yes, they congratulate themselves on showing everybody all the rights that they give to people on paper. But they have very little interest in delivering on these rights on the ground. And I think that a lot of people in the world understand that if you want there to be a synergy between your rights on paper and your rights in fact, or your rights on the ground, if you want there to be a congruence between these two, that all of this depends on the leaders that you choose to make decisions on your behalf. And if you have just leaders, then you have a chance to, for your rights, in fact, to be equivalent to your rights on paper. And this is one of the things that the protesters of today can learn from our Islamic brothers and sisters in Islamic Iran. For in November this year, the American people are going to be given a choice. They're going to be given the choice of choosing between a neo-fascist gangster who is currently in the White House to re-up for 4 years, or to choose a senile old man to replace him. I don't know how they call this freedom. And I don't know how they strut all around the world congratulating themselves on their democracy if this is the choice that they have for their people. And yet, 41 years ago, this is the very same choice that was presented to the Islamic people of Iran. And if you remember, at that time, there was a First World Order and there was a Second World Order. The First World Order, of course, was dominated by the United States and its satellites. The Second World Order, communism, socialism, Marxism, was led by the Soviet Union. And the rest of the world was sort of arrayed behind the First World and the Second World, meaning that whatever decisions any world capital would take, they would have to be approved either by Moscow or by Washington. And when the Islamic Revolution in Islamic Iran was in progress, this was the choice that was being presented to the people, that either you choose a failing communism or you choose a capitalist gangsterism. And had the imam not been leading the people, perhaps they may have chosen anything other than what had placed the Shah of Iran in power. And they may have gone towards socialism and communism and Marxism. But Allah's wisdom placed the imam in charge of that society. Allah's wisdom showed the world another way. And through the agency of his representative on earth, the Imam, Imam Khomeini, the Islamic peoples of Iran, they didn't choose communism and they didn't choose capitalism. They didn't choose socialism and they didn't choose imperialism. They chose a different path altogether, an independent path. They chose to build an Islamic scriptural society. And they chose to do it at a time when nobody else had the courage to make that kind of a choice. And this is what we ought to expect from our leaders today. The Imam delivered, and this is one of his key qualities and characteristics, clarity. The Imam delivered. The people needed clarity. The Imam had clarity, and he delivered for his people. And we ought to demand that of our leaders today. When we can see nothing but fog, we ought to have a leader that can see the light at the end of the tunnel. When all we see are roads that lead to dead ends, we ought to have an imam that can see a clear path. And because of that, the foundations of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic were laid in those difficult early days of the Islamic Revolution. The second thing, in my judgment, that can be learned from our brothers and sisters in Islamic Iran, in the way that they were led by Imam Khomeini, is to identify and to remove obstacles that stand in the way of your mission and vision. And to be mature enough to understand that many of these obstacles are not local. The first of these obstacles is the presumption of innocence insofar as the oppressor is concerned. And the oppressor, and we know who the oppressors are in the world, there's no need for me to provide a list for you. I'm sure that you're well aware of those whom against these protests are taking place today. That oppressor spends perhaps billions upon billions of dollars a year in crafting an image that projects itself as the savior and the defender of human rights, as the citadel of democracy and representative government, as the protector of morality, as the guarantor of freedom. And thereby, anybody who opposes its transgressions, these people are automatically labeled as terrorists, as dysfunctional types, as fundamentalists, as criminals, as backward people, and what have you. And I'm sure that you're aware of all the other different labels that are attached to the principled people who try to confront the injustices of this oppressor. This is the same oppressor that existed at the time that the Imam was launching the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And he completely turned this narrative around. In fact, he took control of the narrative and created a new one. And he immediately labeled this oppressor as the great Satan, Shaitani Bazurg, or a Shaitan al-Akbar. And this immediately did two things for his society and for the world. First, it acquainted his people with a tangible and a physical enemy. It shook them out of their fairy tale world and showed them that they have real enemies in the world and that they have to prepare and they have to be ready for this enemy. For this enemy is not going to sit by while they peacefully build their Islamic scriptural society. The second thing that it did is that the other people in the world that this generational oppressor was degrading, they immediately fell in line behind the Imam. They knew that he was a generational liberator. They knew that when he talked about the Mustad'afin, that he was talking about them. They knew that when he was talking about liberating the Mustad'afin from the oppression of capitalism and imperialism and Zionism, that he was talking about them. And they knew that they represented the majority of the people in the world, that they could no longer be considered to be minorities, that they were the majority in the world. And if they were together under the lead of an imam like this, that they could achieve the same changes that were happening in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for a short time in the world while he was alive, he was regarded as the leader of the oppressed. And this is not a small achievement, where the world's people look to a deliverer and a great leader. The other aspect of this narrative that Imam Khomeini changed was that he exposed a generational racism that was hiding in plain sight. He made it the number one and the ultimate foreign policy objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran to liberate Palestine. He was the first one to do this in the entire Muslim world, and he was the only one to make the key foreign policy objective of a country to liberate the Holy Land. He was the only one to do this in the world. Now, there is an important congruence between the Imam doing this and what is going on in the protests in the world today. For you may recall that at the time of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, for some years preceding the Islamic Revolution, that the most ferocious secret service in the Muslim world, and perhaps even in the world, was the Savak. And just like the local police departments and the regional police departments in the United States, this Iranian secret service was trained by the Israeli Mossad and by the Israeli government. Putting your neck, putting your knee on a person's neck is straight out of the Israeli playbook. And it is going on a daily basis and has been going on a daily basis for the past 70 years. This is nothing new. Only now that the Israelis are training American police departments, anyone who studies the data can begin to trace the police killings that are taking place of their own community members. They can trace these killings to the trainings that have been taking place inside the state of Israel. And one thing that the Imam recognized, that the protesters today ought to recognize, is that if you have, or you think you have rights at home, and that you have peace and security at home, that none of those things can ever be secure if there is a generational racism that thrives in another part of the world. And so he put the animosity of the Muslim peoples of the world with regard to the state of Israel on the map, because he made it the number one foreign policy objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran to liberate the Holy Land. For no generational racism can be tolerated when you have in that same part of the world an activity of Islamic liberation going on. The third thing that the protesters of today ought to recognize is that in order to achieve their mission and their liberation, they have to be able to turn their commitments into conviction through a shared struggle. And the reason that I say this in this way is because the Imam, he knew that soon he came back to the Islamic Republic, to his people, he knew that there was a war coming. That those people who would have to give up their materialistic advantage in that part of the world were not going to sit by and let an Islamic renaissance begin to take place. So he knew that there was a war that was coming. And he was obviously ready for this war, but his people were not ready for it. And so he had to make sure that they were going to be ready for it, because together they would engage in a shared struggle that he would lead. The thing of it is that at that time, the Imam was not inciting any kind of a war. He was not goading his neighbors into declaring war on the Islamic Republic. He was not inviting a war. But what we have to recognize, and what his people recognized at the time, is that his convictions necessitated a war. It was his convictions of trying to build an Islamic scriptural society that brought the war to Islamic Iran. But it was that war, that long 8-year war, where the Islamic people of Iran gave up hundreds and thousands of shuhada. It was that war that converted the Imam's convictions into their convictions, that gave them a sense of their own capacities, that gave them a sense of their strength, their inner strength, that gave them a sense of their creativity, that gave them a sense of their ingenuity, that gave them a sense of their power, that gave them a sense of their own confidence. And the Imam knew that he had to put his people through that struggle, for were it not for that struggle, those people would never have recognized that they can rely on Allah, and that they can rely on His Prophet, and that they can rely on themselves with only those two as their foundations. أَحْسِبَ النَّاسُ أَن يُتْرَكُوا أَن يَقُولُوا آمَنَّا وَهُمْ لَا يُفْتَنُونَ? Is it possible for people to think that they can declare a verbal commitment without having to be tested through crisis and tribulation? These are Allah's words. The Imam was guided by these words, and he knew that the Islamic people of Iran would have to make these kinds of sacrifices in order to get a sense of the kind of power that Allah has placed inside the hearts and the minds of the oppressed. Many of you may remember that in the beginning of the revolution, the very first days of the revolution, that there was a threat of a counter-revolution. There was a threat that the Islamic government that was being ushered in by the Imam would be overthrown. And yet the Imam was wise to the tactics and the strategies of his enemies. And through the decisions that he was making in these crises, he was educating his people how not to panic. And so he ordered his people as a religious duty to be out in the street and to not leave the street until the institutions of that old order came crashing down. And the institutions of that order did come crashing down because the people did not leave the streets. And this is something that the protesters of today ought to recognize, that they have power in the streets. As soon as they place their objectives in front of the decision makers of the old order, they would have lost their momentum. As soon as they allow the corrupt courts and the corrupt institutions of the existing order, the status quo order, to handle their objectives and to try to execute their objectives, all of their momentum is going to be lost. The Imam did not allow that to happen. He knew that the power of the Islamic people of Iran, the power of the oppressed, is in the street, and that they would build new institutions in the street, and they did. And it was these new institutions that replaced the institutions of the old order. And these new institutions are the foundation of the Islamic Republic of Iran today. This is what we need to count on from our leaders, to turn our jihad into our deen. And no one did this better than Imam Khomeini. أَقُولُ قَوْلِ هَذَا وَأَسْتَغْفِرُ اللَّهَ لِي وَلَكُمْ فَاسْتَغْفِرُوهُ يَغْفِرْ لَكُمْ فَاسْتُرْشِدُوهُ يُرْشِدْكُمْ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Thank you so much, Brother Hafeez Khan, for your words of wisdom. And very well said, the cracks are appearing on the level of race. Elected people are becoming Caesars and kings.